I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of the Strand Bookstore in New York City. The store was founded by Fred's father, Benjamin, in 1927. Fred was born in 1928 and has been working in the family business since he was 13 years old. The Strand is located on 12th Street and Broadway and has roughly 2.5 million used, rare, and new books, which is the equivalent of about 18 miles of books. Fred owns the Strand Bookstore with his daughter, Nancy Bass Wyden. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So I typically have founders on the show, since it is a show about the entrepreneurial life, but I think that given that you're in your late 80s, you have some street cred.
Well, I've been running the store since for over 50 years. I was involved in mainly moving to where we are now. So the location we have, I would say I more or less founded that. But
yes.
But I'm not a founder. My dad founded it, and he was excellent. He was a great bookman.
Your father was from Lithuania, and before he started the bookstore, he was in manufacturing. Is that right?
What happened was he worked on 4th Avenue. There was some building there, I think it still exists, that sold cloth. And as a young man, he got a job there. That was 4th Avenue, which was Book Row of America. So he hung around the bookstores, and he got caught in it. He was a big, great reader, great literary man. He knew his books, and he wasn't a great businessman, but he was. Mm-hmm. But most of us booksellers aren't, so.
Uh-huh. Now, were his parents erudite and scholarly?
Or I doubt it.
They came from Lithuania also with him.
No. Yeah. I just remember my grandfather being more of a certain point. He was a carpenter, a very good carpenter. And at a certain point in life, he decided that wasn't what he wanted to do. So he became what they call a Talmudic scholar, which meant a bum. He didn't have to work. Other people should support him.
Well, that's one interpretation. So your father worked on 4th Avenue, which is like downtown Park Avenue.
Yes.
That at the time was called Book Row. He opened up this bookstore called The Strand, which was one of 48 bookstores at the time.
That's right.
Why were there so many bookstores concentrated in this one area?
It seemed to be a publishing and printing area, too. There were a lot of publishers in the area, and or had been. So they sort of, you know, congregated together.
Why is the Strand the only bookstore left from that era?
My interpretation of what happened there, okay, because I grew up with the booksellers there. The 48 booksellers were there were very strong individuals. Great bookman, knew a lot about books, about rare books, used books, everything else. They also were very self-centered people. And they didn't teach anybody anything. Only two sons of 48 booksellers went into the business.
You being one of them?
Being one of them, and Donald Weiser being another. And that was my interpretation. Mm-hmm. Another interpretation was they grew old. There was nobody to take over. And when rents went up, they couldn't cope with it, so they just disappeared.
In this story, your father features prominently because he founded the bookstore. Your mother, where was she in all of this?
Well, she died when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, she was, you know, we used to live on 8th Street, right near Tompkins Park, as a kid. And then I remember her dying there. But I didn't understand what dying meant, so, you know.
So her name was Shirley.
Shirley Vogel.
How did she die?
Cancer.
Did your dad remarry?
After a number of years, he did, yes.
Do you remember your mom well?
No.
It's interesting. I have a 5-year-old son, and it's interesting to think that, God forbid, something happened to me, that he wouldn't remember me in his 80s. But I guess that's what happens when you're only five.
Yeah. I saw a picture of her recently, and it completely threw me. That's what she looked like, because I did have a rough impression of what she looked like. It was different. You know, I didn't realize what the word mother meant until my son was born. And I saw my wife being a mother to him. But you know, at 5 years old, 6 years old, you don't know the difference.
And do you feel like your dad took on a more prominent role, given that he was the only caregiver?
Yes, yeah, of course, definitely. Yeah. It was depression time, too, and he worked very hard, and it was at very rough times.
What are your earliest memories of you with your father?
Well, actually, my earliest memories of him are in the bookstore. We used to walk over to the store all the time, and I'd hang around there. I mean, I could have been 9, 10, 11 years old. And occasionally, he'd put me to work sweeping and doing things like that. That's my earliest recollection of him.
Why did he call it the Strand?
Twofold. We're not quite sure. After the Strand in London, which was a literary street, so that was the interpretation, and the Strand magazine, which is also a literary thing. So we're not quite sure where he got it from. Probably a combined thing of both. Mm-hmm. Actually, the original store was called the Penguin.
The Penguin?
But he immediately had to change that because the publishing firm already had that name, and which he did, but it was just a very short thing.
Did he ever tell you about how he went about founding the store? He had $300 of his own money and $300 from a friend.
That's right. One of the early recollections was of going on the subway, where he picked up a load of books and carried them on the subway back. You know, I helped him carry them, and I always remember the rope cutting into my hands.
You said you would pick up books. Now, you're talking about used books
that you would get
from people's homes or
That's
estates.
Right.
Do you remember specific stories of homes you went into, you know, kind of uncovering these treasures?
Not early, but later on. You know, early we just got used books wherever we could.
You grew up in the book business with your father. Mm. You went to Brooklyn College in the morning, but in the afternoon you would help your father in the shop.
So I scheduled my classes from 8 o'clock to 12, which really determined what courses I took.
Yeah.
And at 12 o'clock I'd get on the subway and come back into New York and work. I lived in the Bronx, so I called Brooklyn College the closest thing to an out-of-town college I could go to.
Was there any question that you would work in the book business in your mind?
Everybody was telling me not to.
Including your father.
Including my father. He said it just was too hard. It was too difficult at the time. But I got hooked. And I'm still hooked by it. I mean, I love what I'm doing. I'm a lucky man. I'm working at a job I like. I mean, I let my daughter run the operation and have her staff and everything else. Mm-hmm. I keep an eye on what things are going on. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to work at that buying counter because that's the fun. That's the treasure hunt. Every morning I come down there and we don't know what we're going to get over the counter or what libraries we're going to unpack because we get a lot of stuff shipped into us and what we're going to find.
What treasures do you find? What did you find most recently, or what features in your mind of things you found in the past?
Well, two of the exciting things that I thought I found, we bought right over the counter, people coming in with them, was a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses, the original first edition, the original paper, the whole thing. And a lawyer came in, he had a part of an estate, he told us what he wanted for it, and we decided to buy it. It was just a great, great thing to have.
When was this?
Oh, about 15 years ago.
What do you buy a book of that nature for? What is the general amount?
I think it was about $7,000 or $8,000. Now it's worth $30,000, $40,000, maybe $50,000. And connected with that was another thing that I get a big kick out of because it's a fun book to have. It's James Joyce's Ulysses, illustrated by Matisse. They're very nice, they're very elaborate, and he signed the book, and James Joyce came along to sign his copies of the book and looked at the illustrations and said, "These aren't to my book." Mm-hmm. Matisse did it to the original Ulysses, and he only signed some of them. And we've got a copy of one of them signed by both. And since I collect Matisse material, I thought this is one of the gems. Another thing we got over the counter, which was very exciting, a man came in with the second folio of Shakespeare, which we ended up selling for $100,000.
These are just people walking in off the street. You never know what they're going to pull from their bag.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, in addition to people coming to you to sell books, you go to people's homes in New York.
Yes.
What are some interesting memories that you have of walking into somebody's home and picking up books? Or
it just seemed I was doing it forever. I would travel everywhere to do it. Now we don't have to do as much of that because most of the stuff is sent to us or brought to us. The store is like a hungry monster. It's got to be fed. I'm shocked myself how much stock we have to put into it every day. We have a system where we're replacing inventory on a daily basis from our Brooklyn warehouses. And a full truck comes along with 60, 70 boxes a day coming in there.
Do you feel, though, that that demand has dissipated since there's this sense of the internet and people reading less? Do you feel that demand has softened?
Yes and no. It's a hard thing to answer, but in some ways it's helped us. For instance, my biggest competitor is probably Amazon because it's, you know, just easy to get them. Mm-hmm. My biggest customer is Amazon. They've given us a new market and taken away part of our market, too. So I just feel that people are getting more and more into some books. And I think the Kindle has, in a way, stimulated a lot of stuff.
I want to continue to talk about the early days and your the influence that the store had on you. In addition to working at the store in the afternoons during Brooklyn College, you also served for a time in the Korean War. And there's a story of you. You had 2 weeks off, and you spent one of those weeks at the store while your dad could go on vacation.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And did you see that?
How
as
did
a,
you dig up that story? Oh, my God.
Oh, Fred. So did you see that as a burden, or did you think, yes, this is where I want to be on my week off?
I felt it was something I had to do. You know, my dad was running sort of a one-man operation, practically. You know, there were tough times, and yet he needed a little break. And also, I got paid a little money for it, so that helped. I had a little more pocket money, so.
Where did you serve?
I ended up serving in Germany.
Do you remember reading during those 2 years?
Oh, sure, yeah. We had access to books that were banned in the United States. The Henry Miller things, mostly. Pornography.
Oh, I don't know Henry Miller.
It was pretty graphic in his sexual things, and he was very good. He was a little outrageous. And I remember when I got out of the Army, I smuggled in a whole batch of them from Europe. I put them in my footlocker, and I got them in here. But I would have been arrested.
Did you sell them at the Strand?
We sold them at the Strand.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of the Strand Bookstore in New York City. We'll hear more from Fred coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of The Strand, a bookstore in Manhattan with roughly 200 employees and 18 miles of books. The store was founded by Fred's father, Benjamin, in 1927. Fred's father, Ben, started The Strand in 1927 with $600 when he was 25 years old. Since the store opened, The Strand has been the home of book enthusiasts, authors, publishers, journalists, editors, and people who just love books. Fred co-manages The Strand with his daughter, Nancy Bass Wyden. Your dad's store was on 4th Avenue. What building was it in? Do you pass that building today? Is the building still standing?
Oh, no, they tore it down. They tore it down. The block we were on was on 4th Avenue between 10th and 11th Street. And the block was owned by the last of the Stuyvesant family. They owned the farm and the land there, and this was the last of them. And a little story connected with that was that during the Depression, Stuyvesant refused to kick anybody out as long as they paid a little. Of course, you had to pay it back. And I remember my dad said we ran 3 years behind in rent.
Was it an act of kindness that Stuyvesant said, just pay me a little until...
Maybe it was just his business thing and saying, you know, empty stores don't bring in any money, you get a little money out of them.
Yep.
It's better than nothing. And if I kick tenants out, they're going to rot, and that's it. And we did pay them back. I remember my dad being very proud about paying them back.
3 years worth of rent.
Well, it's about 3 years. You know, we paid back a little extra, but it was a little extra each month until we caught up. And the story I always like to repeat was that during the war, there was rent control on real estate, commercial real estate.
World War II.
World War II, yeah. The Stuyvesant came along and asked the tenants there for a 15% increase. And there were 5 bookstores on the block, and each one of them refused to give them the 15% increase. But we did, because they'd been so nice to us. And then there was a second one, 15%, that occurred a year later or something like that, and we gave it to them too. Then the rent control was taken off, and they came along and they doubled the rent on everybody but us. They left us alone. So, you know, it's just a nice story I always like and remember it at the time.
What else do you remember about your father other than his work ethic and his love of books?
He loved my stepmother, I know that. And he was very happy with the children. And of course, he was great with my grandchildren, with our children, mm-hmm. too. He was fantastic, grandparent.
How was it working with him?
Challenging. We'd fight all the time. He just didn't understand why I was buying so much stuff and I was doing so many different things and, you know, going in different directions. And I could see it happening with my daughter, too, except she wins more. We all have different ideas, and he had an old-fashioned idea of how to run a place.
What were some changes or additions that you brought in that you feel really helped the business in an important way?
Well, the remainders.
What are remainders? Exactly?
Publishers overstock from the publishers. Mm-hmm. We buy both a tremendous amount here in the States and in England. And it's not just junk. A book can, the way I like to describe it is, a publisher can publish a book and sell 50,000 copies of it, and then print another 50,000 and sell them, and maybe even sell 200,000 copies of it. And then he's got 10,000 left, and they stop selling. Well, here's a book that's a winner, sold 200,000 copies. We buy up some other stuff and sell it at a much cheaper price. That's it.
In 1957, you moved to your current location on 12th Street and Broadway.
That's right.
So this was roughly 30 years after the original store had opened.
Yeah.
That was at your impetus? Was your dad
well,
was still?
Well, we lost the our lease on 4th Avenue because the building was coming down. The whole street was coming down. My dad wanted to go into a mail order operation, and I said we'd starve. And he agreed with me, so we found this location.
What was in the location?
Well, it had originally been a clothing store. Only the front part of the main floor did we take over at that time. And when I took it over, I started expanding. And little by little, I just kept taking more and more space from my landlord. He and I became great friends, but he still was a landlord, and he still was a tough SOB, I'll say that. And eventually I was able to buy the building from him. And we negotiated at Knickerbocker Bar and Grill on University Place. I negotiated at the bar, uh-huh. two leases with him for a long period of time, and I bought the building at the bar. We'd meet there every Tuesday, have a couple of drinks, fight for a little while, and have dinner and go to a jazz club.
When I learned that you owned the building, I thought, well, maybe the building is worth more than the Strand bookstore business. You know, it's a 12-story building.
Yeah. Well, right now we're at the pretty top of the real estate market in New York. Yes, it probably is worth more than the bookstore. And it's very tempting at times to either sell off the building at an outrageous price or rent out the space at outrageous prices and just close down the store. But my daughter, who now makes that final decision, wants to keep it going because she likes doing it.
And you love it. What would you do if you did that? I don't see you retiring.
Well, I'd get drunk all day, that's all. Now I don't have time to drink, that's all.
Are you married?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I do have a wife. I've been married 65 years.
What's her name?
Patricia Ruth Bass.
Does she help you in the business at all?
No, she doesn't work in the business at all. Mm-hmm. No.
And how many children do you have?
Right now, I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. My son died. So my daughter's running it, and she's got quite a challenging life. I don't know if you know this. Of course you do. She's married to Ron Wyden, the senior senator from Oregon.
Yes. So I was wondering about where she's living.
Well, she's living in New York, running the store, and they go back and forth. He comes up practically every other weekend. Now she's out in Oregon with him, with the kids and everybody else. So
the Strand is somewhat of an iconic New York institution. You see people walking around in Strand T-shirts and bags. And did you have a sense for when the bookstore was becoming even larger than itself? Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes, I did, really. But it goes back a long time ago. because at one time we were really very unique. There weren't any bookstores our size. We were low. I mean, this is before Barnes & Noble's opened up their giant stores. We had a store that was 20,000 square feet. There were no bookstores around 20,000 square feet anywhere in the country.
I don't think it's just because of your size, and maybe you did have the books, but there's something else.
Well, one of the things I think that helped the store an awful lot was that we started getting these reviewers' copies.
What are reviewers' copies?
Complimentary copies that are sent by publishers to individual reviewers, magazines, journals, newspapers, to places like the Times Literary Review and all that, for somebody to review and hoping they get free publicity out of this. We bought the reviewers' copies from them, and we made a market, and then we sold them at half price. So they were brand new books. You could come to the Strand and get a book that was just published at half price if I had it. And that has helped our business quite a bit. But part of this is reviewers would come in and bring their copies to us and sell them to us, and then they started hanging around the store, and there was sort of a literary thing with them, and there were some great people that coming in the store and, you know, made some great friends. Anatole Breuard, who used to be a lead reviewer for the Times, and that were there all the time. And with them, you got other people, you know. But the real reason was that we got the books, and we put them out at a good price. And that was my forte of buying as much as I could and getting as much, you know, and going after the books, not just sitting back. So we were very aggressive. And then I was able to develop a staff that was literary and were really interested in the books and helped, you know, with the selections. And
you have a loyal staff. You have members who have been with you for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's one employee, Ben McFall.
Yes.
Who has been with you since 1978, for example. And
he helps people
with their fiction books.
Yeah.
What do you think your staff would say about you?
I don't even think about it. I hope they like work with me. I don't know. I have no illusions about it. I'm the boss. People generally hate bosses. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have no illusions that my staff loves me or anything like that. I just try and work with them at a reasonable level and behave myself. I think most of them like me. And most of them enjoy working with me. But, you know, it's... But there's always somebody with a chip on their shoulder. And
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of The Strand, a bookstore in Manhattan with roughly 200 employees and 18 miles of books. Fred's father, Ben, started The Strand in 1927 with $600 when he was 25 years old. Since the store opened, The Strand has been the home of book enthusiasts, authors, publishers, journalists, editors, and people who just love books. Fred co-manages The Strand with his daughter, Nancy Bass Wyden. You mentioned before that it was challenging to work with your father, and now there are challenges working with your daughter.
Well,
And she's been, you know, you mentioned that you were aggressive, and in a way she's been aggressive in making changes. What are some of the changes that have occurred in the last 10, 20 years?
I think one of the major things she's done is a bigger training program for new employees, putting more systems in to be able to control hiring a better staff. So these people, you know, they won't tolerate any incompetence, let's put it that way, or lying or cheating and things like that. And that helps a lot. She's also got a creative drive of trying to expand what we're doing. And she's made the displays at the store a lot more attractive.
Yeah, so there's been de-shelving in a way.
Well, I'll tell you the story with the thing. We used to have one of the things that was always a big problem in the store, any bookstore, any business, is security. So we used to have a counter up front. It was a double-sized counter. And you came in one side and you had to check your bags. And when you left, you could pick up the bag on the other side. And that sort of controlled some of the stealing. So there are generally three people involved, and when it was really busy, there were more people than three taken there. And it took up a lot of space up front. And one of my smarter managers, I have to say that, they, you know, got the feedback, said, you know, Fred, I've been watching what goes on up there. 10 people come in, and of the 10 people that come in, One is asked. One will refuse to check his bag and walk out. So that's 10%.
You're losing business.
And I discussed this with my daughter. But she came along and she said, look, I can put 3 tables in that area and they're going to bring in $800 a week. Well, that's, you know, it's $2,400 a week. Am I losing that much in stealing? We got rid of the security and made tables into it and made it more comfortable to come in. Now you can walk around the store with bags and stuff like that.
Because now you have video surveillance.
We have video surveillance. We got undercover things going. We prosecute everybody. No tolerance. It's just amazing the people we've caught.
What do you mean?
Professors, lawyers, one guy who worked for the police department, customers that for 30 years. They'll come in and say, hi, Fred, good to see you. And then suddenly, you know. But that's not a major problem in our store. Most people are honest. The second part of this that occurred was the buying counter. It used to be at the side of the store. As you came in to the right side of the store, there was a counter there where we used to do all the buying. And my daughter came along and says, I can put a couple of tables there. You want to move the buying counter down to the basement? And I said, no, I'm not working in the basement, period. That's it, you know. So we compromised and I work in the back of the store. I'm not happy about it. I'd rather be up front where all the action's going and seeing it, but those tables are worth more money than keeping me happy, okay?
I see just walking around people wearing Strand T-shirts and carrying Strand bags. How do you feel when you're walking on the street and you happen to see somebody in?
Oh, very, very happy.
Still?
Still very happy, yeah.
That doesn't subside?
No, it doesn't subside at all, yeah. And when I'm out of the country and I see somebody with them, I'll go over and say hello.
What countries have you been to where you've seen people wearing a T-shirt?
I've been to France and Germany. I was in Italy, obscure town. Some guy comes in wearing a T-shirt and his wife is carrying a Strand bag. And I walked up there, and they were actually from Norway.
Why do you think people like wearing your clothes?
It identifies them with a literary world and an intellectual world. And another story I like to tell, but I probably shouldn't be saying it, was we used to have some policemen who always hung around the store when we closed. And one day, one of the policemen comes up to me and says, hey, can we get a couple of T-shirts? I said, sure. So I gave him, he says, yeah. He says, we go down to the Jersey Shore during the weekends. We wear these things. And the girls think we're intellectuals.
Do you wear Strand T-shirts? Do you wear Strand clothing?
I do occasionally, yeah.
Around the house or?
Around the house or, you know, weekends or, you know, played a lot of tennis. I played a lot of platform tennis where you wear sweatshirts and things of that and heavier stuff. And I always wore the Strand shirts. And
what celebrities have hung out around the store? Do you remember?
Oh, God, I have a whole list. Anna Strasberg, who was the widow of Lee Strasberg, the actor's studio, or the actor himself. He used to come in the store all the time, and I'd supply her with books and things like that. And I'd always say to him, I think you got it, because Lee had an incredible library. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. She says, yeah, but I can't find it. So I'd rather buy a few. And one day she calls me and says, would you, she asked me for 2 books. I said, you want me to send them up? She said, no, I want you to give them to Sophia Loren. But she said, just Sophia. But anyhow, she shows up at the store. I have the books on my desk. I give it to her. She says, no, I want you to give them to yourself. Drags me out, shoves me into the back of a car, and I'm sitting next to Sophia Loren. And I said, oh, my God, you know, gorgeous, absolutely handsome, the most gracious thing. She said, I want to apologize to you for not being able to come into the store and thank you for getting these books.
Why couldn't she come in?
Mobbed. And she said, you know, if I come in there, there'll be people running over right away, autograph this and that. She said, I would love to come back sometime when, you know. I said, well, look, we'll keep the store open all night for you. Yeah, but it was a nice, you know, just a nice touch the way she did it.
Yes.
You know, very gracious, you know.
Do you have any interesting memories from the store that, do you ever remember having a day or a week where you thought, this is the best? Life is wonderful. I just, you know, where you have like those really high moments of work where You just feel
I get them very often. I still get them. I mean, it just happened to be that last week was one of the top weeks we've ever had. That was not holiday. Yeah, I mean, that wasn't, you know, Christmas or stuff like that. And it was the top day for the year. And to happen during the summertime in the doldrums, even with one fully rainy day. And it's not just the numbers. It's the fact that you're pouring out so many books. There's so many people involved. It's, yeah, I still get those days right along. And that's why I'm there. I'm one of the luckiest people in the world. I'm doing work I want to do, and you know, and I can still handle it, so I do it. I'm 88 years old, and my brain is half there, but it's half there. Yeah, my sight is still good enough to read titles.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the privilege of getting on your show. That's very nice. Yeah.
Thank you. My guest has been Fred Bass, owner of the Strand Bookstore. Coming up, we'll meet Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
A smiling face, a fireplace, a cozy room. A little nest that's nestled where the roses bloom. Just Molly and me, and baby makes three. We're happy in mind. New heaven.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar, a company that's focused on making health insurance easier and more accessible. Oscar has built a simple online presence that helps users connect directly to doctors, get prescriptions, and find insurance plans that are easier to navigate. Prior to Oscar, Mario worked at the hedge fund Bridgewater in Connecticut. He's originally from Germany. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be on the program.
Oscar is primarily like a web-based internet company, and I think of the incumbents, these behemoth insurance companies with like mountains of paper and just vastly different from your profile. How is it possible that you are doing the same thing?
Yeah, great question. It actually doesn't happen that often that a technology company comes around and says, I want to be an insurance company. From the beginning, we knew if we are going to walk into the regulatory offices up in Albany in New York State, for example, with just a bunch of coders, just a bunch of programmers, we wouldn't be invited back, you know. So the team we built from the get-go was a team that's comprised of, on the one hand, computer scientists like me, designers, and also a very healthy contingent of very experienced insurance executives. So our chief actuary is the former chief actuary of Emblem, the biggest plan in New York State. In short, what you need to have to become an insurance company is you have to have a lot of money. The regulators will ask you to block away tens of millions in reserve capital, in making sure you can really insure people, that no surprise on medical underwriting losses or gains will financially be an issue for you. And so this is what we do in different states. We're licensed. We block away tens of millions in reserve capital. You have to have a network of physicians and doctors. So you have to go out and actually strike relationships with the people who actually deliver the healthcare. Mm-hmm. And then I think the third thing really is you have to build a incredible backend system where the information that we have on our members' care and our members' medical conditions is so transparent to our nurses on the team, to our customer service members on the team, and to the doctors who work with us, that we can just give you an answer when you call us and get you in with the best possible doctor whenever something's happening to you.
In addition to just providing more transparency to users, you're also changing healthcare practices, like behavior in a way. Like, for instance, telemedicine is probably more prominent in your company than otherwise. Can you talk a little bit about some of those behaviors?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the healthcare system is full of a lot of innovative doctors who really want to help you and take care of you. And a lot of times, the way the system is currently set up kind of gets in the way of these things sometimes. Mm-hmm. Your doctor does not get paid by anybody I'm aware of if he emails you or if he answers a phone call for you. That stuff does not get submitted to the insurance company. And so we from the beginning said, the power of becoming the insurance company is we can start paying for these things. We can start paying for the things in the way people nowadays want to consume their healthcare. And we can maybe stop paying for a few things in the way, you know, doctors shouldn't be delivering healthcare.
So what's an example?
An example actually is televisits. We became the first insurance carrier, really, again, to our knowledge, across the United States, where every member has 24/7 access to telemedicine, which means you push a button and a physician will call you back on average about 9 minutes. Or in about 9 minutes, and we push your full health history out to the doc. He then picks up the phone, calls you back, and then all the notes he takes will come back in real time into our own systems. You can see if the doctor writes you a prescription. You can see which pharmacy this goes to. You can see when the prescription is ready to pick up at the pharmacy and things like that. And we pay for all that. And you can just consume as much as you want. We don't provide the care ourselves, but we can definitely always get you in touch with the right provider and with the right node in the healthcare system.
So you co-founded the company with Josh Kushner. His family is a real estate family. They own a lot of real estate in New York, as well as Kevin Nazimi. And Josh runs a venture capital firm called Thrive, and Kevin is a former Microsoft employee. And Josh really was the one who came up with the idea for Oscar. Can you talk more about kind of his vision initially?
Two things that happened. One is he had played basketball or whatever and sprained his ankle, went to the ER. His mother was there with him. And he was just kind of dumbfounded by how weirdly obtuse the experience is. You know, when do you actually leave this emergency room? He probably got a thousand times photocopied, discharge notes kind of thing when he left that emergency room. He had no idea what's happening to him. And what happened to me at the time was my wife was pregnant with our first kids. And so we were trying to find a pediatrician and a good OBGYN and go into a hospital that wouldn't have too high of a C-section rate because we wouldn't have a natural birth. And all these questions where if you called your insurance company, I'm not sure how much of an answer you would really get that is satisfactory to these questions. And so in that backdrop, against that backdrop, Josh said, let's start an insurance company. And the point, I think, where I really, as a sort of computer scientist again, with a real need to get better healthcare as well, got excited is when I realized two things about insurance companies. One was the insurance company really sits in the middle of all this data and information flowing through the healthcare system. That was one thing. And the second thing was the insurance company also controls the way the financial incentives work in the system. You know, they could pay for free televisits. They could pay for when your doctor is nice and emails you back on his Gmail accounts. That's what a nice doctor does, you know. And so the insurance company could do something about this, but in my experience, hadn't done anything about this stuff.
Now, you met Josh. You were a student in Harvard Business School while he was a student at Harvard College. How did you meet?
I was at McKinsey for a few years. I went to HBS saying, all right, enough of this consulting stuff. I want to get back to starting some companies and back to programming. And so I spent my 2 years basically just writing codes. One of the things I was building was a social network for no particular reason. MySpace was kind of at the peak, I think. You know, Facebook had just come out. And so another friend of mine at HBS by the name of Daniel Caffey from Honduras, he had this idea of saying, let's start a Facebook for Latin America. And so Josh and him and I got together about that idea and then did that as well.
You brought on board very early on Kevin Nazimi, who was at Microsoft. Why did you include him in the mix?
He, I think, was the most healthcare-oriented of us. He had worked at a healthcare IT company, essentially a company that built a claim system in the summer at Harvard Business School. And so from that time, he actually knew a few people who were involved in or who had been executives or were executives in insurance companies. Mm. And so one of the very first people who was an insurance executive came through Kevin. Then that guy's name is Dave Henderson. He's still in the team. He's still one of the important people in the company. And, you know, the guy who had the requisite and necessary gray hair, which I now have as well, to explain to us how regulation works and all that kind of stuff.
You needed to raise a lot of venture capital because, as we talked about, you know, in order to get approval in these states, you have to prove that you have a pile of cash. And your first venture capital came from Thrive Capital. And other people joined on board, like Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal, and Vinod Khosla of Khosla Ventures. Can you talk to me about that venture capital process?
Yeah. Oscar, very much, and probably this is true for many startups, that's end up being successful, in many ways, is a right place, right time kind of thing. You know, so if you recall that I was talking about early 2012, what didn't enter the equation for the first 6 months really was the fact that there was the Affordable Care Act coming. We had no idea, to be honest. This OSCAR was not a deliberate play on regulatory change in the healthcare system. It was really, okay, this experience stinks. Let's try to do something about that. Then we realized there is a very narrow time window for the first time in 20 years and probably never again in the next 20 years to start an insurance company, because the individual market is coming. The ACA, Affordable Care, creates this market where individuals for the first time buy insurance, where you can build a brand, where you can build tools that people would fall in love with and really want to engage with, and so on. And that took a while to really figure out. When we then talked to the first venture capitalists, we talked to all of the big guns. What was funny to me there was that they all had a different idea of what the Affordable Care Act does, and it was wrong in all cases. None of the guys, the venture capitalists at the time, had on the radar screen the fact that there would be a giant market created overnight of individuals buying insurance.
And this is all made possible by the Affordable Care Act, yeah, that Obama instituted in 2012, which basically allows individuals to buy access to health insurance, and the insurers can't turn somebody down even with a pre-existing condition.
That's exactly what it is. You can't get turned down. Everybody pays the same price. It was very much a chicken and egg game at the time. You know, we had to, on the one hand, get deep enough into a regulatory process to show to the venture capitalists that this would become a viable entity. And then also show to the venture capitalists we are deep enough in a regulatory process that we think they should fund it. You know, and that was a difficult thing. And I think what was kind of interesting to me in hindsight was, as a founder nowadays, when you go to a VC, and you show them a video, you know, you sort of say, hey, here's a mock-up of how I think my site will look like, my product will look like, they will laugh you out of the room. You know, they would much rather see from a technical founder a listing, a code, some codes, you know, like on the screen, like here's my Xcode or whatever with a bunch of stuff I can compile, you know, and you can look at it and see how it works. If we had pitched that way to regulators, they would have thrown it out of the room. And so we actually went to the first ever regulatory meeting we had the day after Sandy, the hurricane. We kind of like trekked up from Manhattan and drove up to Albany. And we actually had a video, an animation of how we think the product would eventually work once everything gets pieced together. And that got the regulators very excited, because they've never seen this. You know, they were at the time fighting with the big insurance incumbents, trying to drag them into the Obamacare exchanges. And then once we went to venture capitalists, we actually showed, no, we are in the regulatory process. And now fund this in time for regulators to get comfortable with and eventually issuing the license.
Who was an early investor who really bought into this? What was the first serious capital you got?
Instrumental, I think, was General Catalyst up in Boston. And Joel Cutler, the leading partner there, was actually the sort of like guy who groomed Josh to become a venture capitalist. And so one of the first tracks we made was up to Boston to pitch to Joel and his team. And the instrumental guy in that team was a guy named Charlie Baker, who actually nowadays is the governor of Massachusetts. So Charlie Baker had been the CEO of Harvard Pilgrim, one of the biggest insurance companies in Massachusetts. And Joel eventually, he turns to Charlie Baker and he goes, okay, Charlie, what if we took this thing and we sent it to one of the big carriers? What would happen? And then Charlie goes, I don't think they would know what to do with it, you know? And so then Joel is like, you kind of see the light bulb go off in his head, and he realized what the sort of like competitive advantage could be.
You have positioned yourself as like a company that wants to keep it simple, right? Mm-hmm. And wants to keep healthcare and health insurance simple. And your ads help to perpetuate that. They're kind of quirky and cartoonish. I kind of think of like emojis.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about that evolution? Like give examples of some of your Subway ads,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, when we tried to put together our first campaign, this is in late 2013, we thought, okay, somehow we have to stand out. And so the campaign we came up with was a really very simple one where we have just a monochromatic background and one funny line on there, and then some sort of like very simple, somewhat cartoon characters or drawings that draw some additional attention. And a couple of the lines would be nice articulate doctor call you back without joining a dating site, or health insurance that won't make your head explode, and if it does, you're covered.
Right. Why were your investors in Silicon Valley kind of reluctant to have you put up these Subway ads?
There was one investor, I'm not going to tell you who it is, where we had a lot of fights in kind of late 2013. And it wasn't really at the time very popular for a technology company in New York to be in the subways. It was sort of like applying the classical Silicon Valley maxims and axioms to how you build a user base to this thing, and including also all the usual Silicon Valley bullshit terminology. And subway ads really weren't part of it. And we just really thought that if we only do online ads, right, that we would never really get members' trust, because we sort of felt you had to see us in some, in a couple other media channels before you would really believe that Oscar is a viable insurance company here to stay. And so the subway ads became far and away the most visible thing, I think, for us in hindsight.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar, a company that's focused on making health insurance easier and more accessible. What has been harder than you thought in all of this? I mean, because you knew it was going to be pretty intractable, but what has been even harder than you thought?
Well, I think the complexity of the industry is absolutely breathtaking. So typically, I think if you talk to any technology startup, you don't build technology for, you know, the edge cases, the edge use cases, for the thing that you expect once in 1,000 years or so. You build technology for, you know, what the majority of users will fall in love with and want and so on. That's not something you can do in insurance. Every single, this is a saying we have internally, we literally sometimes say, oh, this is extremely unlikely, which means it will happen next week. Because any single combination of a number of incredibly remote variables will happen to you. And the problem in insurance is, There is a correlation between how unlikely something is and how difficult, costly, and impactful in somebody's life it is. Mm-hmm. We had a member literally who was about to lose one of his limbs because one of his physicians told him he will have to lose his limb. And then in a conversation with one of our nurses, we were able to get him in touch with a different caregiver with a more modern view of the condition he was going through, who was able to help him save his limb, and then and member ended up baking cookies for the office. Member who we had helped go through this case in a good way.
Here you are now living in New York, yet you're German. Like, do you have any recollections of, you know, your experience with the German healthcare system growing up, or
yeah.
I don't know any?
I think. I definitely do. I mean, two things I remember. One thing is my family physician in Germany. My family physician there is a guy, he's in his 70s, and he kind of shuts down his practice every afternoon at 4 p.m. or so, gets on his bike and bicycles around town and visits the old people who are in his practice and kind of like delivers the care in their home. Why the hell does he do that? He does this because this is actually his financial incentive to do. The German government, the way it reimburses him is it pays him a quarterly stipend to take care of every old patient on his panel. And so that incentivizes him to make sure these people actually don't come to his practice. He wants to make sure they're healthy. And so he'd rather see them at home before they come in, get sick. And then he has to actually, you know, do much more with them than he otherwise would if he just kept them healthy.
Right.
And so that is one of the fundamental problems in U.S. healthcare, that's not the way U.S. healthcare works. You know, here a doctor gets paid on a fee-for-service basis. Every single little thing you do when a person comes to your practice, that's what you get paid for. Nothing else you get paid for. Okay, so that's sort of like one recollection I have in the way the systems are different. The other one I have is actually also kind of interesting. The interesting thing in Germany is that even though it is more socialist and everybody has insurance and the government pays for it and so on, there is a tier of insurance. It's called actually private insurance that you can only buy if your income is beyond a certain level or if you work for the government. And so my father is a middle school teacher, which counts in Germany, used to count as working for the government, basically. And that's why I actually was able to go, when I dislocated my shoulder, for example, to a doctor who wouldn't see patients who are in public insurance. And it's a very odd sort of like island of pure sheer capitalism, you know, in this sort of like ocean of more equitable thinking about insurance that I actually found kind of weird. And so it shows the complexities of designing the right kind of healthcare system. And I think what I take away from it is that I very much like the fact that, if you want to get political for a second, that's in the U.S. there is competition in the healthcare system. I like the fact that we, as an insurance company, were able to found a competing health insurance company and try to rewire the underlying healthcare system we reimburse and drive change in the system from the perch where we sit.
So I want to switch to your personal life. You are married to a Brazilian woman and you have two children. How did you meet your wife?
I met her actually in, this is probably the meeting place where Europeans and Latin Americans meet in New York in front of Marquee, the nightclub.
Oh.
So, which is not a story we're necessarily proud of, you know. But she is a PhD in biology, and she came here from Brazil and worked as a postdoc in a lab at Columbia University. And so, you know, we had something to talk about right away.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mario Schlosser, co-founder of Oscar. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.